In the hall outside their mother's room, Mary said, I guess all these years Lydia has been projecting her secret same-sex attraction onto me. Liz looked at Mary. Do you really think that? She has no idea how mean people can be, because usually she's the mean one. The pleasure in Mary's voice was undisguised. Living her whole life is this skinny, cutesy blonde. Well, she's about to learn. I don't think most people who meet him have any idea he's transgender, Liz said. Although, it also doesn't seem like either of them is trying to hide it. Exactly, Mary said, because Lydia doesn't know any better. And trust me, this is the kind of gossip that spreads like wildfire. Lydia and Ham are living their truth, Liz said. More power to them. Chapter 133. It was displeasing and confusing to be back in her childhood bedroom again so soon after leaving, and especially after its fumigation with chemicals whose ostensible harmlessness Liz was not entirely convinced of. Though she'd been away from Cincinnati for only 4 nights, Liz also felt a strange envy for the version of herself who had formerly inhabited this room and had, however unwittingly, enchanted Darcy. The net result of her time in California, she feared, had been to decrease his affections. Though moments had seemed promising, something between them had come loose when she'd canceled breakfast and asked him to drive her to the airport. She thought of texting him to say she'd made it safely back, and wished he'd asked her to when he'd dropped her off. But what if, at this very moment, he and Caroline Bingley were sharing a laugh, standing close to each other, with Caroline looking bitchily gorgeous in an expensive frock. The timing of it all was dreadful, yet somehow unsurprising. That on the cusp of finally having an honest conversation with Darcy, an interruption would come from her family, and with the whiff of scandal attached. It was, in Liz's opinion, a mistake to see symbolism in one's own life, but still, the necessity of her abrupt departure from California felt almost punitive. She wondered if she was being karmically reprimanded for her previous treatment of Darcy. Sleep overtook her eventually, but even then, woven throughout the night's dreams, her remorse did not abate. Chapter 134. When Liz entered her mother's bedroom in the morning after a run and a shower, it was nearly 9 o'clock and her mother was on the phone. You should check again, Mrs. Bennett was saying. They might have gotten there right after you left. It was difficult for Liz to envision her father and Kitty in Chicago. Were they driving up and down Michigan Avenue or wandering on foot around Navy Pier and Grant Park? Were they loitering by the closed courthouse or entering restaurants, showing photos of Ham and Lydia from the screen of Kitty's phone? Or were they simply, as seemed most likely, in a hotel room watching television? For God's sake, Fred, you need to find her, Mrs. Bennett said. I didn't sleep a wink last night. A few seconds passed before Liz realized that the phone call had ended, and her mother's most recent remark was directed at her. I'm sorry to hear that, Liz said. What's it called when they slip pills into girls' drinks? Mrs. Bennett said. They do it at fraternity parties. I wonder if that's how Ham got her to Chicago. Mom, I'm sure he didn't give her roofies. Here's a question for you. Which locker room does Ham use when he swims? Because no one at the Cincinnati Country Club would want to change into their bathing suit around a person like that.
Ham can put on a bathing suit at home, Liz said. There are ways around it. But I bet he uses the men's locker room. Just think of him as a man, Mom.
Lydia will never be able to have babies.
Mrs. Bennett scowled at Liz.
And at the rate you're going, neither will you.
Lydia and Ham can adopt, or... It was impossible not to think of Jane. There are other options. Mrs. Bennet shook her head.
When people adopt, God only knows what's in those genes.
God only knows what's in any of our genes, Liz said, and Mrs. Bennet drew herself up into a haughty posture.
I beg your pardon, she said. Your father and I both come from very distinguished families.
Chapter 135.
Still no word from Lydia, Jane said.
Liz had brought her laptop and phone to the backyard and was sitting in an ancient patio chair with flaking paint. She said,
Since they didn't take their cell phones, I assume they're not planning to be in touch until they get back to Cincinnati.
What Jane did then was surprising. She laughed.
Lizzie, Jane said, Of course Lydia took her phone. She'd sooner lose a limb.
As soon as Jane said it, Liz realized her sister was correct.
Wow, she said. I'm an idiot.
I feel like I should be there, Jane said. But Mom would take one look at me and know, and this doesn't seem like the right time for her to find out.
You don't need to come home. Mom's driving me crazy, and Mary's MIA. But I don't know what there would be for you to do.
It sounds silly, but I keep picturing Ham's goatee.
He must take testosterone, Liz said, and thought of Darcy.
What I wonder is, Jane said, if Ham was choosing from all the male names in the world, why did he pick Ham? I know it's short for Hamilton, but that's still kind of odd.
Do you know what his name was when he was female?
No, Liz said.
I wish I knew him better, Jane said. I guess now I'll get to.
I shouldn't even tell you this, Liz said. But there were new unopened Horchow boxes in the front hall when I got home last night, and there's a bunch of raw steak in the refrigerator. Oh, and donuts on the counter. Apparently, Mom and Dad are very receptive to our concerns about their physical and financial well-being.
All we can do is encourage them when they make good choices, Jane said. We can't micromanage their behavior.
So, Lizzie, I think I felt the baby kick.
Wait, really?
It was this flutter that didn't come from my own body.
That's so exciting.
I know. Then Jane said, Promise to call me the minute you hear anything from Chicago.
Chapter 136.
Although she knew she was supposed to be concerned about Lydia, Liz felt more preoccupied with whether she'd hear from Darcy. As she had previously planned to do, he was taking a red eye, though having seen Pemberley, she suspected he'd be flying first class. As Labor Day proceeded in a decidedly un-Labor Day-ish fashion, Mrs. Bennet continued to weep and brood in her bedroom, Mary hadn't yet come to the tutor, and Liz wasn't sure whether to resent Mary for staying away or be relieved by her absence. Liz imagined Darcy's activities. He wouldn't, presumably, leave for the San Francisco airport until around midnight in Cincinnati. So she pictured him packing his suitcase in the Pemberley guest house, perhaps going for a run or playing Scrabble with Georgie. Liz had no idea if Darcy and Georgie played Scrabble. Had Caroline Bingley returned yet to Los Angeles? Liz certainly hoped so. Intermittently, her mother would summon her to unhappily speculate about Ham, sometimes from a new angle and sometimes from angles previously explored just a short time earlier. Otherwise, Liz busied herself with tidying the tutor, as well as with aggressive sniffing in cabinets in the corners of rooms for lingering traces of sulfuryl fluoride, Ken Weinrich's reassurances notwithstanding. While she wished that her impatience as she waited to hear from Darcy would cancel out her impatience as she waited to hear from Lydia, the opposite proved true. Doubly restless, Liz kept experiencing phantom buzzes in her pocket, incoming texts that turned out not to exist, She began composing in her head the pseudo-off-the-cuff missive she'd send when Darcy returned to Cincinnati. Hey there, wondering if you're free to get coffee/dinner/whatever before I go back to New York. Having already changed her plane reservations twice since leaving Cincinnati for Houston, she no longer had a ticket to New York, but she figured the implication of urgency couldn't hurt. In the early afternoon, Liz was driving home from the Smoothie King in Hyde Park Plaza when her phone buzzed with a real and actual text. It was not, however, from Darcy or Lydia. It was from Georgie. Liz, the text read, it was so great to meet you. I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline, and now I feel very awkward about the conversation you and I had. I really wish I'd bitten my tongue. I can't wait to read your article about Kathy DeBerg, and I hope we cross paths again soon. Liz's heartbeat sped up unpleasantly, and continued to do so as she read the text a second time, searching for the part where Georgie specified what Liz might have heard about Darcy and Caroline. Really, though? Was specification necessary? Still, it was shocking that exactly what Liz had feared might happen had happened. Hadn't she been devoting enough anxious attention to this eventuality to preclude it? Had discussing the subject with Charlotte not been a sufficient method of warding it off? There was nothing to do but change clothes and go for another run. Although 32 ounces of pureed raspberry and mango were sloshing in her stomach, she couldn't just sit inside the Tudor, knowing that Darcy and Caroline were together. How could they be together? Was it possible that Liz had imagined all the fraught energy between herself and Darcy and Atherton? His solicitousness? That moment when they'd almost kissed? Had he invited her to breakfast to tell her that he and Caroline were a couple? To officially retract his affection and establish a more friendly and informal mode, should he and Liz encounter each other in the future? Her hands shook as she tied her sneakers. In the second floor hall, she called, "Mom, I'm going for a run," and left without either waiting for a response or taking a key. Once outside again, she didn't bother stretching in the driveway, but simply sprinted off. For half a mile, adrenaline and bewilderment spurred her on, and her pace was far faster than usual. But sorrow and smoothie gas soon triumphed. She decreased her speed, and tears welled in her eyes. She had been prepared to admit her mistakes to Darcy, to make amends and humble herself. Now Caroline had robbed her of the opportunity. And even worse, Darcy had let Caroline do so. As Liz reached Madison Road, tears fell down her cheeks, and an undeniable cramp took hold on the right side of her abdomen. And then she was sobbing. She was full-on heaving, in the middle of the day on a busy street, and instead of making a right, she crossed Torrance Parkway, took a seat on a public bench, and gave in to a combination of regret and sadness that caused her to gasp and shake. She hunched over, her elbows pressed against her thighs, her hands covering her face, and tears and mucus cascaded down as she wept and wept and wept. After an indeterminate amount of time, a tentative voice said, "Honey?" Liz looked up. It was a slim, middle-aged black woman who also appeared to be exercising. She wore sturdy white walking shoes, shorts, and a T-shirt featuring the University of Cincinnati Bearcat. "Are you okay, honey?" Liz ran her palm upward over her nostrils. "I'm heartbroken," she said, because it seemed the most succinct way of conveying the facts. "Oh, honey," the woman shook her head, "aren't we all?" Chapter 137. "I know you have your phone," Liz typed in a text to Lydia. "I'm not telling you not to marry Ham, but why don't you reach out to M&D and tell them you're fine?" No reply was immediately forthcoming. Although she suspected it would achieve little, Liz also looked up the number for Ham's gym and left a message. She was lying in bed in the dark when, she was almost certain, Darcy's plane took off from San Francisco. There was only one direct red eye from SFO to Cincinnati. She no longer was waiting to hear from him, but the desolation inflicted by Georgie's text had scarcely decreased. This new development had to be more than just a few stolen wine-facilitated kisses between Darcy and Caroline, didn't it? Or else Georgie wouldn't have referred to them in such an official way. They, too, wouldn't have eloped, would they? The thought was truly sickening. During the many years of romantic torment meted out by Jasper Wick, Liz had routinely cried herself to sleep. But that had been a while ago, and the nocturnal weeping Liz was gripped by in her childhood bed in the Tudor didn't have a recent precedent. It was almost, almost unfamiliar. Chapter 138. 72 hours passed before Liz received acknowledgement of the text she'd sent Lydia. And when it came, Lydia's response contained no words. It was a photo of herself and Ham standing in front of a white wall, a round blue Cook County seal partially visible behind them. Ham was dapper in a button-down shirt and sport coat, a red rose on his lapel, and Lydia was unforgivably young and stunning in a sleeveless white dress. Behind her right ear was tucked a red rose that matched Ham's. Together, the two held out a light blue piece of paper covered with writing too small for Liz to decipher, except that at the top, in capital letters, it said, "Certification of Marriage." They both were beaming. "Congratulations," Liz texted back. "You guys look great." And then, "When you coming home?" Again, there was no answer. Chapter 139. Mr. Bennett and Kitty returned to Cincinnati on Thursday evening, 4 days after they'd departed and just a few hours after Liz had received the photograph from Lydia. Her father and sister had never encountered the newlyweds. Mrs. Bennett was, as usual, in her bed. The demands of the Women's League luncheon, pressing as they were, had been set aside all week in order for her to devote herself full-time to her shame and distress. And Mr. Bennett and Kitty entered the room to deliver a report devoid of news to her, Liz, and Mary.
"Did you really find out nothing in all that time?" Mrs. Bennett asked her husband.
"I learned that it costs $47 a day to park a car at the Hilton."
Mr. Bennett seemed extremely weary.
"Anything else, Kitty?"
"The bean is cool. I always knew there was something off about Ham," Mrs. Bennett said. "He had a funny look in his eyes, and I didn't trust him."
"They're probably on their honeymoon by now," Mary said with malicious delight.
"Kitty, what do you think?" Liz said. Surely, if Liz had been in touch with Lydia, Kitty had too. But Kitty merely shrugged. "We should hire a detective," Mrs. Bennett said. "Fred, remember when the Hoseleys were getting divorced and Marilyn hired someone to follow Buddy?"
"Actually," Liz said, "I've heard from Lydia."
"You didn't think to tell us?" Mr. Bennett said.
"It wasn't very long ago, and she didn't say anything. It's a picture."
Liz tapped on the message icon on her phone's screen, then on the photo itself. Ham and Lydia in their dressy clothes, holding their marriage certificate, looking jubilant. She showed it to her father first, and his expression seemed to be one of muted amusement. Kitty said, "Wow, she looks fierce." And Mary said, "Then I guess it's a done deal." When finally Liz brought the phone to her mother, Mrs. Bennett peered at it with pursed lips and burst once more into tears.
"If that's how Lydia wants it, then fine,"
Mrs. Bennet said.
Fine. But I'll have nothing more to do with either of them.
Chapter 140. Liz found her father in his study. She said,
You know when we were talking about if Mary's gay, and you said people can do what they want as long as they don't practice it in the street and frighten the horses?
Mr. Bennet sighed.
It appears your youngest sister is doing everything in her power to call my bluff.
I realize that being transgender seems weird to you, Liz said, but the world has changed a lot.
Indeed.
I don't want us to be one of those families that has a huge rift and doesn't speak to each other. Do you?
What would you have me do?
Help Mom get past this. When Lydia and Ham are back in Cincinnati, invite them over for dinner like normal. Or, I don't know, give them a waffle iron. They didn't get married despite you guys. They're in love.
Mr. Bennet smiled wryly.
I suppose they are, he said. But that's a condition that's acute, not chronic.
Chapter 141.
When did you know? Liz asked Kitty. They were in Kitty's car on their way to pick up dinner from Bangkok Bistro. Did you know as soon as you guys started doing CrossFit? Basically. So it's not like Lydia was flirting with the gym owner, then found out he was transgender. She knew all along?
It's the kind of thing people talk about.
It's also, like, Ham is insanely strong. He can do 50 pull-ups in a minute, which is amazing. And when you consider that he was born a girl? Clearly, Liz thought, Kitty didn't share her concern about using politically incorrect language. Kitty added, If anything, Ham being trans made Lydia more intrigued.
I wonder if she'll become an activist for LGBT causes now, Liz said, and Kitty laughed.
That isn't how she sees herself at all, or how she sees him. She definitely thinks of him as a guy, and she's into the whole chivalry thing.
Well, it does sound like his first-hand knowledge of women's bodies is a bonus with sex.
Ugh!
Liz put up a hand, her palm to Kitty, and Kitty laughed again.
You're such a prude. I'm not a prude, Liz said. Good for them, but I don't need to hear about it.
Then why are you asking me all these questions?
Chapter 142.
Lydia's text arrived in mid-morning the next day, sent as a group message to Jane, Liz, Mary, and Kitty.
We're coming back tonight, having a party. Can you guys get some alcohol?
Another text followed.
At our place around 9.
And then a third.
No champagne, too sugary, but tequila/hard cider, not the cheap kinds.
An explosion of sororal texts ensued. From Kitty.
Congrats!
From Jane.
I wish I could be there. Congratulations.
From Mary.
Are you enjoying being a lesbian?
From Liz.
I think it's important for you to reach out to M&D.
From Kitty.
They're acting bonkers.
From Liz.
Also tell Ham I look forward to having him as a brother-in-law.
From Mary.
Brother-in-law.
From Lydia.
Mary, trust me, Ham is more masculine than 99% of dudes out there.
From Lydia.
M&D can think whatever they want.
From Lydia.
We use a 9-inch dildo. Mary, you should try it sometime. Maybe you wouldn't be so fucking grumpy.
From Lydia.
Isn't it funny I'm the youngest, but the first to get married?
Chapter 143. The remarks that had previously echoed in Liz's head,
I'm in love with you. I can't stop thinking about you,
had been replaced. As she stood in the shower rinsing shampoo from her hair, as she ate a turkey sandwich,
as she drove to Hyde Park Wine and Spirits and compliantly purchased non-cheap tequila and hard cider, and then to Joseph Beth Booksellers, where she acquired a paperback titled Transgender 101, A Simple Guide to a Complex Issue. The line that echoed instead was, "I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline." Driving along Edwards Road, she thought, "I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline. I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline. I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline." Back in her room, Liz looked online and found the location and meeting times of a support group for family members of transgender individuals. She then found the names of three family therapists, copied down the information by hand, folded the piece of paper, inserted it into an envelope on which she wrote, "Mom and Dad," and attached the envelope to Transgender 101 with a rubber band. Finally, when she could think of no other gestures to convince herself she was a dutiful daughter and sister, Liz booked a ticket on a flight to New York for the following morning. Chapter 144. Lydia wore a short yellow sundress and flats, and she did seem filled with a newlywed bliss Liz had never really believed existed. By way of greeting, the bride held out her left hand to Kitty and Liz. Mary had decided not to attend the party, and an enormous emerald-cut diamond ring atop a diamond-encrusted wedding band caught the light.
"We got them at Tiffany's on the Magnificent Mile," Lydia said. "They cost $20,000 altogether."
"They're pretty," Liz said. "Did Ham pay in cash?" Kitty asked. Ham approached then. And though Liz detected in him an underlying wariness as they both leaned in to hug, he too seemed genuinely happy.
"Congratulations," Liz said. "Welcome to the family."
"I realize this didn't play out in the ideal way," Ham said, "but I hope you know, Liz and Kitty, that I intend to honor and care for your sister."
His earnestness was both touching and embarrassing. Also, Liz was aware of scrutinizing his goatee in a way she hadn't in the past. She murmured, "Of course."
"I plan to keep trying with your parents," he said. "I think it's best to let them have some space for now, but I'm not giving up."
"I'm glad to hear that," Liz said. And then a tall, red-haired woman she'd never met embraced Ham, and in doing so interrupted the conversation. About 36 other guests, visibly athletic men and women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, plus a smattering of preppy young women who were childhood friends of Lydia's, milled about. Ham's house was a narrow and immaculate 5-story dwelling in Mount Adams, with a granite-filled kitchen and a roof deck. Setting her tequila and cider on the dining room table, where a bar had been assembled, there were, in fact, some bottles of champagne, one of which Liz poured from for herself. Liz was accosted by Jenny Tiedelbaum, Lydia's best friend from Seven Hills. At a normal volume, Jenny said, "Isn't it crazy about Ham? I would never have guessed." In the hope of setting an example, Liz lowered her own voice. "I'm excited for them," she said.
"I hear your parents are freaking out," Jenny said, "which is so understandable."
"Are you still teaching kindergarten?" Liz asked. After hearing in detail about the whimsies of 5-year-olds, Liz found herself in the living room, at the edge of a conversation about whether clean and jerks or burpee pull-ups were the single best CrossFit exercise, when Ham tapped a fork against his glass. He stood in front of the fireplace, Lydia beside him.
"Thank you all for joining us tonight," he said.
And this remark alone prompted clapping and hoots.
"I just want to say, on behalf of Lydia and me, we're thrilled to have you celebrating with us. And we appreciate your support as we enter the next stage of our lives together. And I want to say to Lydia, baby, thank you for making me the happiest guy alive."
They turned their faces to kiss, and the cheering that ensued was positively uproarious. When the embrace ended,
Lydia raised both her arms above her head like an Olympic skier who'd completed a victorious run. "Turn on the music!" she cried out.
And Liz couldn't tell if the first dance that followed, to Aerosmith's I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, was planned or impromptu. That Lydia and Ham were in love seemed beyond doubt. A few minutes later, while Lydia was dancing with Jenny Tietelbaum, Liz tapped her sister on the shoulder. "I'm headed out," she said. "Congratulations again."
Lydia's expression was scornful.
"It's not even 11. I'm going back to New York in the morning. Lydia, I really hope you'll get in touch with Mom and Dad. Don't nag me at our party. They might be old and weird and narrow-minded, but they're the only parents you have."
"Oh, my God, can you even stop for 1 second?"
Lydia reached for Liz's hand, grasped it, and began twirling under their linked arms.
"Have you completely forgotten how to enjoy yourself?" Lydia asked, and Liz thought, maybe.
She stepped in and hugged her loathsome, charming younger sister.
"Keep me posted," she said.
Chapter 145. Outside, Liz walked briskly to her father's car and was just a few feet from it when she heard her name. She turned to see Ham jogging after her.
"You slipped out without giving me a chance to say thanks again for coming tonight."
"Really?" "Thanks for including me," Liz said automatically. And then they both were quiet, and Liz wondered if they would continue to be part of each other's lives for decades to come. If Ham and Lydia would stay married.
"I hope you don't feel..." Ham paused. "I guess, misled."
"I don't care that you're transgender," Liz said. "And even if I did, I realize you don't need my approval. But it'll be a huge bummer if Lydia becomes permanently estranged from our parents."
"No one wants her to have a good relationship with them more than I do," Ham said. "I didn't plan to..." "She was the one who had the idea of eloping. I could have said no, obviously. But what if I did and your parents succeeded in turning her against me? I couldn't risk losing the love of my life."
To be adored as deeply and inexplicably as Ham adored Lydia. Would she herself, Liz wondered, ever experience it?
"I decided the best strategy was to tie the knot now, then spend as long as it takes convincing your mom and dad I'm a good guy,"
Ham was saying.
"That's still my aim, and I welcome your advice."
"So, the other stuff you've told me," Liz said, "or your bio on your website, I'd understand if it's not, but is it all true? Were you in the army, and did you grow up in Seattle?"
"It's definitely all true," Ham said. "I was commissioned into the Signal Corps as a female, and I had a different name, but yes."
Liz sighed. "Do you think the storage locker with all the stuff from my parents' basement is infested with spiders?"
"That crossed my mind. I can check. Liz, I know that Lydia can be hard on you, but your opinion matters a lot to both of us. I'm really happy we have your blessing, and I promise I'll make things right with your parents."
"I believe you," Liz said. "Now go inside. You're missing your own party." As Ham stepped forward to hug her once more, she said, "Lydia's lucky she found you." Chapter 146. Liz's plane landed at JFK shortly after 11 a.m., and as it taxied toward the gate, she switched the setting on her phone out of airplane mode. Immediately, three texts popped onto her screen, one of which was from her editor, Talia, a second from Jane, and a third that read,
"It's Darcy. Hope things are okay with your family. Can I buy you a drink this weekend?"
Her heart stretched and contracted. Why now? Of course now. "I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline," Liz thought.
and the idea of sitting in a bar listening to him describe his renewed romance made her glad she'd left Cincinnati. She was ready, more than ready, to once again inhabit her life in New York. So it hadn't worked out with Darcy. She was 38, and it hadn't worked out with plenty of guys. "Actually, I'm back in NY," she typed hastily. "Looks like we're ships passing in the night. Take care." Then she hit send. And within a few minutes, she was off the plane and hurrying through the terminal, buoyed, however temporarily, by the relief of resolution. Part 3. Chapter 147. For the morning of the Women's League luncheon, Liz had ordered a large bouquet of pale pink roses, hypericum berries, and sweet peas to be delivered to the tutor, along with a card bearing her and Jane's names. During the luncheon, she texted Mary and Kitty to ask how it was proceeding. "Fine," Mary texted back. "Almost over." "Picture a sorority that time-traveled 50 years," Kitty texted back, "except drunker." Neither of which exactly answered Liz's question. The day before, Liz had heard from Shane Williams that another couple was preparing to make an offer on the house, and she had purposely withheld this information prior to the luncheon. Upon calling the tutor in the late afternoon, she learned from Mr. Bennett that her mother had retired to bed. "In defeat or triumph?" Liz asked, and her father said,
"It's hard to tell sometimes, isn't it?"
Chapter 148. The initial offer was for $899,000. After negotiations, it stalled at $920,000, which Shane told Liz and Mr. Bennett in a conference call he strongly recommended accepting.
"Unless you want to take the house off the market, make improvements, and put it up for sale again in the spring," he said. "But with the school year underway and the holidays on the horizon, now just isn't when most people are looking to move."
The second time around, the inspection did not yield surprises. A closing date was set for October 18th, and Liz booked a ticket to Cincinnati accordingly. Chapter 149. September in New York was still prone to unpleasant hotness, but by October, which had always been Liz's favorite month, the city was at its best. The leaves in Central Park were changing color. The stylish women who worked at Mascara and its sister magazines were wearing belted coats. And her favorite deli was selling pumpkin soup. It had occurred to Liz that her extended stay in Cincinnati might distance her from her New York friends, or even from her own habits there. But in fact, she appreciated the city anew. And the affection appeared reciprocal. She went out often for drinks, dinner, or brunch, in many cases with people she hadn't socialized with for over a year, and there was much to gossip about and discuss. Though she made a point of calling her parents every other evening and texting her sisters as often, if not more so, the absence of constant familial obligations made her feel as if additional hours had been inserted into each day, hours in which she could read novels, attend movies, go for long runs, or visit museum exhibits that she probably, the previous spring, would have intended to see without actually doing so, believing herself to be too busy. A few weeks had passed before Liz realized that these auxiliary chunks of time were attributable not simply to no longer being at the beck and call of her family, but also to the conclusion of her relationship with Jasper. It was in the second week of October, with neither delight nor vengeance, that Liz discarded the red sheer teddy and matching thong underwear, never worn, that he'd sent her in Cincinnati. She also recycled the piece of computer paper on which, over a decade and a half, she had written what she'd once deemed Jasper's best sentences.
"I talk way more openly with you than I do with her. Sometimes I think you and I would be a good couple. I love you in my life."
How meager these offerings had come to seem. How provisional their compliments. Yet surely she was as culpable as he was. Recalling her casual speculation about when Jasper's wife's grandmother might die and thereby free Jasper and Susan to divorce, Liz wondered if a stronger sign of a relationship's essential corruptness could exist than for its official realization to hinge on the demise of another human being. In any case, when the autumn nights most filled Liz with yearning, when, as she was leaving work, the smell of candied cashews and fallen leaves wafted through the cool air, the person she thought about wasn't Jasper. Chapter 150. Congratulations, Kathleen Bennett, read the email Kitty had forwarded to Liz. The Kenwood Institute of Cosmetology is pleased to offer you a place in our rigorous and state-of-the-art 16-week manicuring program. Your session will begin on Monday, November 4th, 2013. Happy now? Kitty had typed above the Institute's digital letterhead, and Liz wrote back, Yes, very. Good for you. Chapter 151. Mrs. Bennett was the one who called Liz, which was unusual, unless there was a sale on bath mats at Gattle's. Your father has gone to a lecture with that deviant, Mrs. Bennett practically hissed. Can you imagine? Do you mean Ham? Liz asked. I don't know what your father's thinking. Liz had been pleased to hear that Mr. Bennett and Lydia had met on more than one occasion for breakfast at the Echo. But as far as she knew, this was the first time since the elopement that he had socialized with Ham. What's the lecture about? She asked. That has nothing to do with anything, Mrs. Bennett said. A modicum of research revealed that the two men had heard a professor at the University of Cincinnati speak on law and politics in ancient Greece. Are you a history buff? Liz texted Ham.
Whatever it takes, Liz, Ham texted back. Whatever it takes. Smiley face.
Chapter 152. Using a smartphone matchmaking app that hadn't existed the last time she'd been single, Liz embarked on a series of dates that were neither terrible nor particularly promising. The fifth man she met for a drink turned out to be someone with whom she had gone out on one date 7 years earlier, though neither of them realized it until they were seated across from each other at a restaurant on East 36th Street and had been talking for 10 minutes. The man's name was Eric, and he was now living in the suburbs of New Jersey, divorced, and the father of a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. He was a perfectly pleasant person. But as they spoke, all the things that had bothered her the last time around bothered her again, with only the slightest particulars changed. She hadn't been aware of storing this list of deterrents to dating Eric Zanti in her brain for 7 years, but once it got reactivated, there was no denying that it was there. He didn't read much, she said, because he was too busy. He enjoyed small game hunting, though on a recent guys' weekend with his buddies, he had taken down a 150-inch white-tailed deer. He thought his ex-wife spent too much time on Facebook. In her 20s, Liz had lived with a roommate named Oscar who loathed grocery shopping. She said that looking at all the food in the aisles, thinking of the meals she'd need to fix day after day and year after year, filled her with despair. Parting ways with Eric outside the restaurant, they kissed on the cheek, and Liz stifled the impulse to make a joke about seeing him again 7 years hence. Liz understood Oscar's despair, except with men instead of food. Even before she returned to her apartment, she had deleted the matchmaking app from her phone. Chapter 153. During the 48 hours she was in Cincinnati for her parents' move from the Tudor and the subsequent closing at the title company, Liz looked for Darcy. She looked for him running on Madison Road as she drove back and forth. Her own trips were staggered with those of the movers. Between the Tudor and the Grassmoor, which was the building where her parents had, after all, decided to live, though they were renting a two-bedroom rather than buying a three-bedroom, and using the funds that might have served as the down payment to maintain their country club membership. She looked for Darcy downtown, when she and her father went to the title company's office. She had never previously encountered Darcy downtown, and while she waited at the Dewey's in Oakley to pick up a pizza for her parents' first dinner in their new dwelling, she looked for him on her own run the next day, and it would have been a lie to claim she didn't consider stopping by his apartment, but it was 7:20 in the morning, and he had a complicated work schedule and a girlfriend. "I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline." Before flying out, Liz met Ham and Lydia for lunch at Teller's.
"I don't know if Lydia mentioned that I wrote a letter to your mom," Ham said. "Unfortunately, I haven't heard back."
Over pizza the previous night, Liz had inquired about whether her mother had considered breaking the silence between herself and her youngest daughter and her husband.
"I certainly haven't," Mrs. Bennett had declared.
"I think she still needs time," Liz said to Ham. "Maybe after they get settled into the new place, she'll be more receptive. But I'm glad you're trying."
"Lizzie, I have a question," Lydia said. "Have you ever gotten your eyebrows threaded?"
The three of them had stood to leave the restaurant when they saw a middle-aged woman Liz recognized as Gretchen Keefe, who decades earlier had been their teenage babysitter and neighbor on Grandin Road. Gretchen was accompanied by another woman, both of them wearing black leggings, recognizably overpriced hooded sweatshirts, and large diamond rings.
"Hey, guys," Gretchen said warmly. "Is it true that Mary eloped with a transvestite?"
Liz winced as Ham extended his hand and said with equal warmth,
"Actually, I'm transgender, not a transvestite, and married to Lydia here. But nice to meet you. Hamilton Ryan."
"Oh, my God." Instead of shaking Ham's hand, Gretchen brought her own hand to her mouth. Her face had drained of merriment.
"Is it true," Lydia said to Gretchen with feigned brightness, "that you and your husband haven't had sex in 15 years? Because that's what he told Kitty last summer while she was trying to swim laps."
"I didn't realize," Gretchen said. And Liz said too loudly,
"Yeah, lots of changes in our family. In fact, our parents moved from Grandin Road yesterday. The house had just gotten too big for them."
This was what Mrs. Bennett had explained to Abigail Rycraw, a widow and Women's League member they'd run into in the Grassmoor parking lot. And her mother had said it so convincingly that Liz briefly thought she believed it. Gretchen looked to be on the cusp of tears, and Liz said,
"Anyway, nice to see you."
She glanced at Ham and Lydia and pointed toward the front of the restaurant.
"Shall we?"
Outside on the sidewalk, Lydia said, "Gretchen Keefe sucks."
"You need to grow a thicker skin, baby," Ham said. "You'll get there."
"Sorry," Liz said, and Ham shrugged.
"I've heard worse."
Chapter 154.
"Remember that guy Darcy who dissed you at the Lucas's barbecue?" Mary texted Liz on Halloween. "Just saw him at Skyline, but he was bizarrely nice."
Liz was at her desk at Mascara, preparing to enter a 1 o'clock meeting. Another text arrived from Mary.
"Maybe he's bipolar."
"What did you talk about?" Liz typed, then deleted. "Was Chip's sister Caroline with him?" she typed, then deleted that too. "Did my name come up?" she wrote. And this she also deleted. Finally, she wrote, "I guess he likes chili." And that was the text she sent.
Chapter 155. Jane's 40th birthday fell on the first Saturday in November, and Liz traveled by train to Rhinebeck to help set up the dinner party Amanda and Prisha were hosting. Liz had made two earlier trips to Rhinebeck and been reassured both times to see that her sister's coloring was rosy, her demeanor was upbeat, and a small, enchanting bump protruded a little more from her midsection with each visit. By her birthday, Jane was 22 weeks pregnant and downright voluptuous. She wore empire waist shirts that emphasized her full breasts, and jeans whose stretchy belly panels she revealed to Liz with amusement. "You're like a fertility goddess," Liz said, and Jane laughed but didn't seem displeased. Mr. and Mrs. Bennett called in the afternoon to sing Happy Birthday. This was the only duet Liz had ever known her parents to perform, and the guests arrived around 7. Friends of Amanda and Prisha's, whom Jane had recently come to know, a Barnard classmate and her husband living in nearby Kingston, a pair of yoga studio colleagues who, like Liz, had made the journey from the city. Though Jane didn't drink, Amanda broke out several bottles of what Liz recognized as expensive wine. Liz had brought a cake from a Cobble Hill bakery. On the crowded train, she'd sat with the cake box on her lap like an obedient child, holding above it the book she was reading. And despite the filling meal, no one declined a slice. Liz shared the double bed in the guest room with Jane and her body pillow, and on Sunday morning, while Amanda and Prisha were still asleep and their son was watching television, the sisters went for a stroll on the woodsy, sidewalkless roads around their host's home. "Does being 40 feel fabulous and foxy?" Liz asked. "More like fatigued and foolish," Jane said, but she sounded cheerful. "Thanks for coming up to celebrate." "How are you doing on money?" Jane shook her head. "Amanda won't let me pay for anything, and their friends have been amazing with hand-me-downs. Now I just have to figure out how to break the news to Mom and Dad." "Mom still hasn't spoken to Lydia and Ham, has she?"
"I don't think so."
"Did you hear that Lydia registered? Which, not to sound like Mom, but is that allowed if you elope?"
"I'll have to order her something," Jane said.
"How about dinner china that's $240 a setting? Or perhaps you'd prefer the $650 juicer."
"Are you making those up, or are they real?"
"To be fair, the juicer also chops and purees." Jane laughed.
"Maybe I can afford to buy her part of a fork." "Lizzie, I don't know what I imagined my financial situation would be when I was 40, but mooching off friends? It wasn't this."
The surprise, Liz thought, wasn't that someone rich would swoop in to subsidize Jane's pregnancy. The surprise was that Jane had arrived at a point where she needed subsidizing. So refined and delicate was Jane, so charming and beloved, that a certain inevitability had surrounded her courtship with Chip, and it was their breakup rather than their coupling that felt like a deviation from the script. Also, Liz wondered, was it indecorous of her to feel relieved that obscenely successful Amanda, rather than middling Liz herself, was supporting Jane? Should Liz insist on taking responsibility as a family member? Aloud, Liz said, "They seem fine with your so-called mooching."
"You would never do it. In fact, the opposite. Aren't you paying Kitty and Mary's rent?"
"Only until they finish their classes and get jobs. I have one more thing to tell you about Lydia. She took Ham's last name, so she's Lydia Ryan now."
Jane said. "I guess she's traditional after all."
Chapter 156. It wasn't unexpected to run into Jasper. Given the smallness of the Manhattan media world, the only question had been when the encounter would happen. The answer turned out to be a Wednesday evening publication party for a White House memoir by a former national security advisor, also known for her magnificently toned calves. The party occurred at an event space on the 22nd floor of a building on Columbus Circle. Three other people entered the elevator in the lobby with Liz, and just before the doors closed, an arm shot through them, followed by a male voice saying, "Hold up!" Presently, the rest of Jasper appeared. He and Liz made eye contact, and he smiled.
"Hey, it's you."
Guardedly, Liz said, "Hi." He had always been handsome and still was, but Liz noticed for the first time how old he looked. His curly blonde hair was more silver, and the corners of his eyes were marked by crow's feet. When had this happened? She didn't derive pleasure from her observations. Instead, they made her sad. Everyone disembarked on the 22nd floor, and Jasper set a hand on the sleeve of her coat to hold her back. He said,
"I'm trying to respect your wishes here, but do you really need to starve me out?"
"I'm not starving you out."
"What then? We're just done? After everything?"
"You had your chance."
"If you're boning some other dude, just promise me it isn't Darcy."
She said nothing, and as more guests spilled out of another elevator and passed them, Jasper added,
"Can't we at least grab coffee? I miss our conversations."
She pulled her arm away from his grasp. "Then I guess you shouldn't have treated me like you did." Chapter 157. The text from Kitty arrived while Liz was pulling laundry from the dryer in the basement of her building. "M&D took Alan H. out for dinner at Country Club last night. Thought you want to know." Liz called her sister immediately.
"This is huge," Liz said.
"Don't you think?"
"I guess."
Kitty's voice sounded flat, possibly bored.
"Are you painting your nails right now?"
Liz asked.
"If I was," Kitty said, "how would I just have texted you?"
Chapter 158. Liz telephoned her mother next.
"I heard you and Dad had dinner last night with Lydia and Ham."
"There's a new shrimp pasta on the menu," Mrs. Bennett said.
"I wasn't in a seafood mood, but I think I'll get it next time. And Lydia had the filet mignon. The club always does a good job with that."
Knowing she should leave well enough alone, Liz said,
"Are you okay now with Ham being transgender?"
"Oh, that's a birth defect," Mrs. Bennett said quickly. "It's like a cleft palate. It's not for any of us to question God's plan, but all you need to do is look around to know some people aren't born the way they should have been." Was this a theory espoused in Transgender 101, A Simple Guide to a Complex Issue? Not having read the book, Liz couldn't be sure.
"Ham is thinking of opening a second gym," Mrs. Bennett was saying. "All his classes have wait lists, so expanding would make sense."
She sounded, Liz thought, uncannily like the version of herself she had always yearned to be. A mother-in-law bragging about the successful husband of her daughter. Then she added,
"Lizzie, I can't find a very nice throw pillow that I bought at the old house. It has a pineapple on it. Do you remember seeing it?"
For a few seconds, Liz froze. Then she said,
"Maybe it got mixed up with the donation items for the auction."
Chapter 159. The text from Darcy, which arrived just after 10 o'clock on a Thursday night, read,
"Hi, Liz. I'll be in NYC next week, and I'd like to take you and Jane out for dinner. Are you free either twos or wed? I realize this is short notice."
How perplexing these few lines were.
Why would Darcy wish to have dinner with her and Jane? Did he remember that Jane no longer lived in the city? Perhaps, Liz thought, he hoped to avoid issuing an invitation that might otherwise sound like a date. And then, as sometimes happened, the memory of Darcy's declaration, he'd been in love with her, he'd wanted to be her boyfriend, flew through Liz's head, followed by that dreadful echo. I'm sure you've heard from my brother about him and Caroline. Yes, there'd been extenuating circumstances, but none, Liz thought with sorrow and regret, had been extenuating enough to absolve her. Chapter 160. Liz's profile of Kathy de Burgh appeared in the December issue of Mascara, and Jasper's article about Cincinnati's powerhouse squash tradition appeared in the December issue of Sporty. The two magazines hit newsstands within a day of each other in early November. By the afternoon, six people had texted or emailed Liz about Jasper's article, four of whom knew she knew him and all of whom knew she was from Cincinnati. She read it that night. Only after finishing it, the focus switched between the coach and the 11-year-old boy with the intense father, did she realize that a part of her had expected Jasper's article to morph from a straightforward sports feature into a breaking-the-fourth-wall direct address to Liz herself, a postmodern confession or a self-exculpation on Jasper's part. Yet it was none of these things. It was only about squash. Was she disappointed or relieved? She'd have expected the former, but instead, without doubt, felt the latter. The next morning, Liz discovered that after going to bed, she had received a two-sentence email from Kathy de Burgh. Dear Liz, thank you for taking the time to depict me with respect and accuracy. I enjoyed meeting you and am most appreciative. Kathy. Liz hadn't previously communicated directly with Kathy de Burgh and was briefly unsure how to address her. Then, decisively, she typed, Kathy, the pleasure was mine. I'm delighted you enjoyed the article. Liz. She forwarded Kathy de Burgh's email to her editor, Talia, prefacing it with the word nice and three exclamation points. Chapter 161. Through an exchange of texts with Darcy that didn't veer in subject from logistics, Liz had agreed that she and Jane would meet him at 7 o'clock at a bistro in Lower Manhattan. Jane, who was reluctant but obviously sensed Liz's wish for her attendance, arrived in New York via train in the afternoon. Though Liz wished she could be as indifferent to Darcy as Jane was, an irresistible curiosity gripped her. The evening might leave her bruised or remorseful, but she was compelled to know why he wanted to see them. As they entered the restaurant, Liz's heart pounded and her body pulsed with a jittery energy. Following the maitre d', Liz made eye contact with Darcy from several feet away, and when he stood, without smiling, he held up his right hand, an odd happiness swelled within her. Oh my God! Chip's here, Jane said. It was true. Liz had been so focused on Darcy that she'd failed to notice that Chip was also waiting at the table. Liz glanced at her sister and said, I had no idea, I swear. Jane bit her lip and Liz said, Is this okay? We can leave. It's fine, Jane said quietly. Even before they reached the table, Liz felt herself over-smiling, talking too loudly, and with excess enthusiasm. Hi, she said to Darcy and Chip. Chip, what a surprise! Chip was now standing too, and the physical and symbolic intricacies of all of them greeting one another seemed nearly insurmountable. Thus, despite her misgivings, Liz threw her arms around Chip in the friendliest and most Midwestern of hugs, and he half-hugged her back while kissing her right cheek, She then hugged Darcy. Had the two of them ever hugged? Not, she was pretty sure, while clothed. Even as this thought formed, the hug had concluded, and they were all sitting. She wondered if the man were shocked by the size of Jane's belly. "What are you doing here?" she said to Chip with great energy. And though she willed herself to turn down both the volume and the chumminess a notch, the strange and ambiguous situation was impelling her to take the reins of the conversation. "Are you in New York for long?"
"I'm not."
Though he was considerably more subdued than Liz, his voice contained its usual sincerity and kindness.
"But it's really good to see both of you."
It was clear that the sentiment was directed at Jane. Every molecule of Chip's body seemed turned toward and attuned to her. Was it possible, Liz wondered, that he found this lushly, curvy version of Jane to be as beautiful as Liz herself did? When he said to Jane,
"I hope you've been well,"
such depth of feeling infused his tone that the wish did not seem inordinate. "I've been living up in Rhinebeck, which is very relaxing." Jane removed the napkin from the table in front of her and unfolded it on her lap. "Are you still in California?"
Chip nodded. "We wrapped the eligible shoot in October."
Liz wanted to ask if he'd found love, of either the genuine or the scripted variety, yet posing the question in Jane's presence seemed cruel. Instead, Liz said, "So what's next for you?"
"Funny you should ask. I've gotten an agent, actually, who's talking to some folks about my hosting a medical talk show on cable. It'd be a roundtable thing. Me, a nurse practitioner, an alternative type like an acupuncturist or chiropractor. I'm hoping it